Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here today. As Julia mentioned, I will be talking about postpartum contraceptive practices among low-income first-time mothers in New York City. And this data comes from our Nurse Family Partnership Program, which I'll tell you a little bit more about. I'll be showing data at 6 months and 12 months postpartum and discussing the factors associated with consistent contraceptive use. So Nurse Family Partnership is a multi-level home visiting intervention for low-income first-time mothers. It is replicated in the United States and internationally. It's based on three randomized control trials where they saw positive effects in pregnancy outcomes, child health and development, and improved parent outcomes, including economic self-sufficiency as well as decreased rates of jail time and decreased amount of time on welfare. The program starts during pregnancy and continues throughout the infant's second birthday. So it's a very intensive program with visits happening on a weekly and bi-weekly basis depending upon the schedule. In New York City, we have been implementing NFP since 2003. We've served over 6,000 families, and our active caseload right now is about 2,300. Again, these are all first-time mothers on Medicaid, and they had to be at least 28 weeks pregnant to be enrolled in the program. Our maternal race ethnicity breakdown is as follows: 43% Black, 42% Hispanic, 3% White, and 12% Other. The median age of the mothers at intake is 20 years old, and 43% of these clients are teens, and 32% are 20 to 24, 15% 25 to 29, and 10% 30 plus. So what I want to talk to you a little bit today is about the theoretical model that NFP works through. The nurses work with clients on their one-to-one bi-weekly visits to help identify maternal health habits and infant caregiving and work on the personal accomplishments of the mother in the areas of work and education and family planning. So in these visits, they develop a therapeutic relationship where nurses teach clients about self-efficacy and encourage the new mothers to help them identify plans for the future, with the theory that if the parents have a vision for their future, they're more likely to plan subsequent pregnancies, continue their education, and find work. Planning for the future consists of setting and achieving educational and professional goals, finding sustainable work, and counseling women on family planning and the benefits of birth spacing. All of this work is embedded throughout the curriculum in an effort to optimize overall maternal economic self-sufficiency. For example, the nurses ask clients to fill out a dream sheet where the client thinks about what her life will be like in the next 3 years and how she can be a mom and balance work with school and parenting. No small feat for anyone, especially these very high risk women who oftentimes have never had any sort of mentor or role model in these areas. Another way to execute lessons on economic self-sufficiency is to talk about contraceptive use and family planning with life goal planning as a mean to achieve these goals. So with this in mind, we sought to understand how contraceptive practices were being promoted by NFP and to assess if economic and educational life goals are associated with consistency. And so we wanted to assess how New York City data was aligned with NFP's theoretical model that economic and educational life goals are related to contraceptive practices. And we really wanted to determine trends in the data so we can continually improve the program and provide a feedback loop to our nurses. So I'll be showing you some data from New York City, NFP, at 6 months postpartum compared to New York City women overall. So for our New York City data source, we used PRAMS, which my colleague will be presenting more in depth on. PRAMS is a pregnancy risk assessment monitoring system. As many of you know, it's implemented in New York City. It's a CDC survey on women in the postpartum period, but assessing their attitudes and behaviors prior to pregnancy, during, and thereafter. And there's questions on contraception. So we're able to look at NFP data, which is collected throughout the program, on contraception, and NFP collects data on contraception at 6, 12, 18, and 24 months by the NFP nurses. That's self-reported by the clients. So for these purposes, we can compare NFP client data to the to New York City data in the six-month postpartum period, because it's the closest time period that matches, since PRAMS collects data anywhere from 2 to 6 months postpartum through a telephone and paper survey. We limited our PRAMS survey, which is a representative sample of all New York City women, and we limited it to just low-income first-time mothers to get it as comparable as possible to our NFP sample. And we limited both groups, NFP and New York City overall, to women who reported any sexual activity and women who had neither been sterilized nor partnered with someone who had been sterilized for the purposes of this study. So what we see here is the proportion of mothers in NFP, the red bar, as compared to our New York City overall first-time low-income mothers, blue bar. And we see a statistically significant higher proportion of mothers, 87% in NFP, reporting any kind of contraception in this six-month postpartum period. Now taking a look at the types of contraception methods being used between NFP, comparing NFP to New York City overall, I'm going to highlight here the methods that are significantly different between NFP and New York City. So there's a higher proportion of NFP moms using condoms, a higher proportion, almost double, of women in the postpartum period using IUDs among our NFP clients. There's a lower proportion in NFP using dual method, which is condom plus a hormonal method, and a lower reported use of any non-hormonal method as compared to New York City overall. And that 9% is mostly attributed to the withdrawal method. Non-hormonal is characterized here as rhythm, spermicides, diaphragm, and withdrawal, and it's mostly in, as the women in the PRAM survey report, PRAMs, withdrawal. So now I'm going to transition to 12 months postpartum period, and this is just NFP data because PRAMS doesn't collect this far out. And we have a unique opportunity here to use NFP data to understand what's happening further out in the postpartum period when women's lives are changing. And oftentimes 6 months or in the early postpartum period, it's may not reflect a woman's behavior and attitudes towards contraception much later after she's getting accustomed to being a mother and her life is changing on a regular basis. So we had an opportunity here to look at the factors associated with consistent contraceptive use at 12 months postpartum. Our outcome here is consistent contraceptive use. We actually do have subsequent pregnancy data through PRAMS. It's self-reported, and 12 months postpartum, about 9% of the moms report a subsequent pregnancy. We chose to use contraception here as our outcome, however, because we were really interested in looking at the modifiable risk factors that are associated with contraceptive use, as opposed to just looking at pregnancy as the outcome. It also would make the outcome much smaller, since only 9% reported, and we do believe there's some errors because it's a self-reported measure. So for our outcome, consistent contraception, our definition is using any contraception every or most of the time, and inconsistent is defined as half, none, or some of the time. And I'd just like to make a note here that none is in the inconsistent group, which is a little funny, but just keep that in mind. It's just the term inconsistent. But these are women, all women who are sexually active, so it's important to include the none in the inconsistent group. And we included clients who participated in NFP for at least 12 months and excluded clients who were sterile or reported any abstinence at that time period and performed multivariate and bivariate regression analyses. So we see the frequency of birth control use at 12 months. Our sample is about 1,000 women. You'll see on the right-hand side, 59% reporting every time, 15% reporting most of the time. So 74% are in our consistent group, which is great, but there's 26% which are in the inconsistent group. And so it's an important opportunity to understand why some women in this very intensive home visiting program that are receiving a lot of information, a lot of services, are still reporting inconsistent birth control use. And so here we see contraceptive methods divided out between that inconsistent group and the consistent group. And so if I direct you over to the left-hand side, these are the methods that are the most inconsistently used, the first one being condoms and non-hormonal combinations. Other combinations, then non-hormonal methods. These are the most likely to be inconsistent. And the consistent methods of contraception are not surprisingly hormonal and IUD all the way on the right. I think it's funny that there's a slight proportion of the IUD reporting inconsistent use, and it could just be reflect a lack of information or knowledge exactly about how IUDs work. But I think it's important to note here that the methods that are inconsistently used are the ones that require attention and action in the moment, like a condom, and other barrier methods. So I'm presenting to you demographic factors associated with consistent contraceptive use. We looked at maternal age, race, ethnicity, marital status. For maternal age, being 18 to 19 was statistically significantly associated with consistent use, and being 30 or older was more like these women were more likely to be inconsistent users. The other age groups were not, there were no statistically significant differences. For maternal race ethnicity, the group that was more likely to be an inconsistent user were the Black non-Hispanic women. And among marital status, the women who were currently married versus formerly married were more likely to be inconsistent users. We did also assess income, but there was no difference, so it's not presented here. And that may be because the income levels are so homogenous, because it is a program for low-income women. And we also assessed cohabitation status, but it was not significant. We also looked at other factors associated with contraceptive consistency. School and work engagement were important variables that were part of that theoretical model that we were interested in. And interestingly, those who were enrolled in school but not working were more likely to consistently use. Those enrolled in school and working, both, were more likely to consistently use contraception. And if they were enrolled, if they were neither enrolled in school nor working, they were more likely to be inconsistent users. We also had some variables on positive affect. It was a mental health score that we put together, and if you had a positive mental health score, you were more likely to be a consistent user. And if you had any history of emotional or physical abuse, you were more likely to be an inconsistent user. So taking all the variables that we just presented that were significant and putting them into the model, we looked at the predictors of consistent contraceptive use. And these were the predictors that held significant in the model. Being 30 plus had a higher likelihood of inconsistent contraceptive use. So the odds ratio here is less than one, and our outcome was consistent contraceptive use. And women who are Black non-Hispanic also were less likely to have consistent contraceptive use. And the with the school and work variables, the ones that held in the model, were the women who were doing neither school nor work, neither engaged in school nor work, were less likely to consistently use. And that positive affect score showed that those were the women who were more likely to be consistent users. So our main results show that women who are non-enrolled or school or working, either full or part-time, are significantly less likely to consistently use contraception. Women aged 30 plus and Black non-Hispanic women were less likely, and women with a positive mental health at intake are more likely to consistently use. Some study limitations is that this is a paper survey reports that the nurses are filling out with the clients, and so there's a lack of qualitative data on other circumstances surrounding the clients' lives, since we know there are so many other numerous factors, family, belief systems, societal factors, and some of the main things that we cannot assess that relate to these influences in these systems are pregnancy intentions and ambivalence. It's also self-reported data. And we do have a lack of New York City comparison data on 12 months postpartum and on all the other factors that I presented too, namely the educational and workforce variables, which are really critical to looking at their associations. So in conclusion, these results reinforce NFP's theoretical model and its holistic emphasis that contraceptive consistency is associated with school or work engagement. These findings indicate that school or work may be used as a marker for life course attainment, and the results that suggest that birth control usage may increase and become more consistent when clients have established educational or career goals and have identified their goals related to the spacing of subsequent children. We also thought that a significant finding were the higher rates of IUDs among NFP mothers compared to New York City overall, which I can talk a little bit more about why that might be, and find it an important message to impart back to the nurses and the program, the lower rates of dual contraceptive use, the condoms plus hormonal. So some of our next steps, our main goal is to share the results with our nurse home visitors to assist them in identifying clients at risk for inconsistent contraceptive use and help them in their messaging with clients if they understand some more about the factors associated with consistent use. We are also implementing new family planning questions to our NFP data system that's specific to New York City because we really want to know more about intentionality. And we also want to know more about what happens in the immediate postpartum period at 1 and 3 months and not just at 6 months. So we've implemented that too, and we'll have a new set of data to analyze from. As well as some better measures on mental health. We've been collecting PHQ-9 scores, and we'll be able to analyze that, which I think will be a much more sensitive marker than the positive affect scores I presented. There's also a potential additional source of the material that the nurses are charting that doesn't get routinely put into the large database. And so we have that as an additional source of information. And we do plan to conduct in the very near future focus groups and individual interviews with our clients, as well as our nurses, to understand more about contraceptive attitudes and behaviors and really how this relates to the life course planning goals and objectives of the program, but in general, life course planning for these women that we all pay a lot of attention to and hope and aspire to give as much information to them as possible so that they can make their best choices. And I've included some, here's my contact information. I've also included some references on NFP as well as on other information related to birth spacing and contraception. Thank you. Yes.
You may have said this and I missed it. What proportion of the participants remained in the program for 12 months or more?
So for this analysis, I only included the clients that did reach that 12-month time point. In general, the program is 2 years long, and the attrition rate is quite high. We experience about 40% of the clients drop out. So that is... No, overall. Overall. So it's a little bit lower than that. Actually, the peak dropout is really in that early infancy phase. Women's lives are getting much more hectic, 6 months postpartum, and they're finally getting back to work. And it's actually sort of in conflict sometimes with the goals of the program because we want women to go back to work. We want them to pursue their educational goals. But we also want them to stay in the program, and their hectic lives, it's often really hard to do both. So the nurses do try to work with the clients as best as possible to meet their needs and potentially pare down the number of visits. But attrition is definitely an issue that the nurses care a lot about.
One more quick question. Have you compared your outcomes with your adolescents versus your older ones?
Yes, we do that routinely. For this analysis, I didn't. I had done a subset analysis of teen contraceptive use, and it looks fairly similar to the older women in the program. In fact, our IUD rates were statistically significantly higher than in the PRAMS teen moms, which was a similar finding. And I think that, you know, for the women who are 30 plus in the NFP, some of them might be actually planning another pregnancy, and I think that could indicate why their contraceptive use is less consistent. But because there's such a large proportion of women in NFP that are teens, they tend to be similar in a lot of their methods that they're using and some of the other factors. The most? No, we didn't. We grouped the most together because we had looked at the factors, the way that it was broken out, and we felt that the people that were using most were potentially in that high-performing group, and that if we had lumped them in the inconsistent group, we might be biasing that inconsistent group and inflating them a little bit too high in their practices. But I think that it would be maybe interesting to just do some comparison about of every compared to none, too, and really get sort of the tail end outliers, not necessarily outliers, but sort of the more extreme, and look at those factors.
You could look at none, any, and always.
Right. Yeah, and I think also something that's, you know, sort of interesting from this question, this is an NFP-related question, and I think that category about half of the time is not really a sensitive category at all. You know, I think only two, it's not registering for women what is about half of the time. And so it probably makes more sense to look at just every most, some, or none. And I think to your point, you could maybe just do every some and none and see how that falls out.
Time for another two or so questions?
Yes. Yes, we do have a ton of data on visits, which was not incorporated in this analysis, but I think that's a really good point. Not only is there a lot of disparity on that, the number of missed visits, but there's also so many differences on nurses and the kinds of relationships that get built with the clients. So yeah, I think that's a really excellent point. And I also think that dropout is something to look at, because women drop out for different reasons, and one of the main reasons why they drop out is excessive missed appointments. So they don't actually give a reason for dropout. You sort of can understand it more when someone, you know, says and confronts the nurse and says, "I'm sorry, I can no longer do this. I have too many competing goals, and, you know, it just doesn't happen." And so it's really mostly they just drop out. Yeah, so I think that that's... I think that that's a great point to look at, and I think the challenge is what to do with those women who are at risk of excessive missed appointments and how to engage them.
Yeah, that's something, that's that black box that you need to qualitative research.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Thank you. There's one back there.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could comment on the fact that you had such higher IUD rates among your NFP sample and what you got.
Yeah, I'm happy to answer that. In New York City, we have been doing a lot of work on IUDs, on contraception, on spreading messaging around the safety and the appropriateness of using IUDs in both nulliparous and multiparous women and teens. And we have developed a very good referral guide for other programs at my bureau where Nurse Family Partnership is housed. And so the nurses have really benefited from that because they now know really good clinics dispersed throughout the city where they can recommend a client to and they won't get turned away because, as we all know, that's a huge problem. And so I think that that's one of the main reasons why we're seeing such high IUD rates is because the nurses are getting the information from all of us that work on this on other related topics, and then they're able to impart that information to their clients. Thank you.